he said softly, astonished at the thought. "Don't you ever think of people and of your moral duties?"
"I don't know what it is that you choose to call morality. No, I don't think of people, except that if I gave a job to Philip, I wouldn't be able to face any competent man who needed work and deserved it."
She got up. Her head was drawn into her shoulders, and the righteous bitterness of her voice seemed to push the words upward at his tall, straight figure. "That's your cruelty. That's what's mean and selfish about you. If you loved your brother, you'd give him a job he didn't deserve precisely because he didn't deserve it. That would be true love and kindness and brotherhood. Else what's love for? If a man deserves a job, there's no virtue in giving it to him. Virtue is the giving of the undeserved." He was looking at her like a child at an unfamiliar nightmare, incredulity preventing it from becoming horror. "Mother," he said slowly, "you don't know what you're saying. I'm not able ever to despise you enough to believe that you mean it." The look on her face astonished him more than all the rest. It was a look of defeat, and yet of an odd, sly, cynical cunning, as if for a moment she held some worldly wisdom that mocked his innocence. The memory of that look remained in his mind, like a warning signal telling him that he had glimpsed an issue which he had to understand. But he could not grapple with it. He could not force his mind to accept it as worthy of thought. He could find no clue except his dim uneasiness and his revulsion. And he had no time to give it. He could not think of it now. He was facing his next caller seated in front of his desk. He was listening to a man who pleaded for his life. The man did not state it in such terms, but Reardon knew that that was the essence of the case. What the man put into words was only a plea for 500 tons of steel. He was Mr. Ward, of the Ward Harvester Company of Minnesota. It was an unpretentious company with an unblemished reputation, the kind of business concern that seldom grows large, but never fails. Mr. Ward represented the fourth generation of a family that had owned the plant and had given it the conscientious best of such ability as they possessed. He was a man in his 50s, with a square, stolid face. Looking at him, one knew that he would consider it as indecent to let his face show suffering as to remove his clothes in public. He spoke in a dry, business-like manner. He explained that he had always dealt, as his father had, with one of the small steel companies now taken over by Orrin Boyle's Associated Steel. He had waited for his last order of steel for a year. He had spent the last month struggling to obtain a personal interview with Reardon. "I know that your mills are running at capacity, Mr. Reardon," he said, "and I know that you are not in a position to take care of new orders, what with your biggest, oldest customers having to wait their turn, you being the only decent, I mean reliable, steel manufacturer left in the country. I don't know what reason to offer you as to why you should want to make an exception in my case, but there was nothing else for me to do except close the doors of my plant for good. And I..." There was a slight break in his voice. "I can't quite see my way to closing the doors, as yet. So I thought I'd speak to you, even if I didn't have much chance. Still, I had to try everything possible." This was language that Reardon could understand. "I wish I could help you out," he said. "But this is the worst possible time for me, because of a very large, very special order that has to take precedence over everything." "I know. But would you just give me a hearing, Mr. Reardon?"
"Sure."
"If it's a question of money, I'll pay anything you ask. If I could make it worth your while that way, why, charge me any extra you please. Charge me double the regular price. Only let me have the steel. I wouldn't care if I had to sell the harvester at a loss this year, just so I could keep the doors open. I've got enough personally to run at a loss for a couple of years, if necessary, just to hold out. Because I figure things can't go on this way much longer. Conditions are bound to improve. They've got to, or else we'll..." He did not finish. He said firmly, "They've got to." "They will," said Reardon. The thought of the John Galt line ran through his mind like a harmony under the confident sound of his words. The John Galt line was moving forward. The attacks on his metal had ceased. He felt as if miles apart across the country, he and Dagny Taggart now stood in empty space, their way cleared, free to finish the job. They'll leave us alone to do it, he thought. The words were like a battle hymn in his mind. They'll leave us alone. Our plant capacity is 1,000 harvesters per year, said Mr. Ward. Last year we put out 300. I scraped the steel together from bankruptcy sales and begging a few tons here and there from big companies, and just going around like a scavenger to all sorts of unlikely places. Well, I won't bore you with that, only I never thought I'd live to see the time when I'd have to do business that way. And all the while Mr. Orrin Boyle was swearing to me that he was going to deliver the steel next week. But whatever he managed to pour, it went to new customers of his, for some reason nobody would mention, only I heard it whispered that they were men with some sort of political pull. And now I can't even get to Mr. Boyle at all. He's in Washington, been there for over a month, and all his office tells me is just that they can't help it, because they can't get the ore. Don't waste your time on them, said Reardon. You'll never get anything from that outfit. You know, Mr. Reardon, he said in the tone of a discovery which he could not quite bring himself to believe. I think there's something phony about the way Mr. Boyle runs his business. I can't understand what he's after. They've got half their furnaces idle, but last month there were all those big stories about Associated Steel in all the newspapers. About their output? Why, no, about the wonderful housing project that Mr. Boyle's just built for his workers. Last week it was colored movies that Mr. Boyle sent to all the high schools, showing how steel is made and what great service it performs for everybody. Now Mr. Boyle's got a radio program. They give talks about the importance of the steel industry to the country, and they keep saying that we must preserve the steel industry as a whole. I don't understand what he means by as a whole. I do. Forget it. He won't get away with it. You know, Mr. Reardon, I don't like people who talk too much about how everything they do is just for the sake of others. It's not true, and I don't think it would be right if it were true. So I'll say that what I need the steel for is to save my own business, because it's mine. Because if I had to close it... Oh, well. Nobody understands that nowadays. I do. Yes, I think you would. So you see, that's my first concern. But still, there are my customers, too. They've dealt with me for years. They're counting on me. It's just about impossible to get any sort of machinery anywhere. Do you know what it's getting to be like out in Minnesota, when the farmers can't get tools, when machines break down in the middle of the harvest season and there are no parts, no replacements? Nothing but Mr. Orrin Boyle's colored movies about... Oh, well. And then there are my workers, too. Some of them have been with us since my father's time. They've got no other place to go. Not now. It was impossible, thought Reardon, to squeeze more steel out of mills where every furnace, every hour, and every ton were scheduled in advance for urgent orders for the next 6 months. But the John Galt line, he thought. If he could do that, he could do anything. He felt as if he wished to undertake 10 new problems at once. He felt as if this were a world where nothing was impossible to him. Look, he said, reaching for the telephone. Let me check with my superintendent and see just what we're pouring in the next few weeks. Maybe I'll find a way to borrow a few tons from some of the orders and... Mr. Ward looked quietly away from him. But Reardon had caught a glimpse of his face. It's so much for him, thought Reardon, and so little for me. He lifted the telephone receiver, but he had to drop it, because the door of his office flew open and Gwen Ives rushed in. It seemed impossible that Miss Ives should permit herself a breach of that kind, or that the calm of her face should look like an unnatural distortion, or that her eyes should seem blinded, or that her steps should sound a shred of discipline away from staggering. She said, "Excuse me for interrupting, Mr. Reardon." But he knew that she did not see the office, did not see Mr. Ward, saw nothing but him. "I thought I must tell you that the legislature has just passed the Equalization of Opportunity Bill." It was the stolid Mr. Ward who screamed, "Oh, God, no! Oh, no!" staring at Reardon. Reardon had leaped to his feet. He stood unnaturally bent, one shoulder drooping forward. It was only an instant. Then he looked around him as if regaining eyesight, said, "Excuse me," his glance including both Miss Ives and Mr. Ward, and sat down again. "We were not informed that the bill had been brought to the floor, were we?" he asked, his voice controlled and dry. "No, Mr. Reardon." apparently was a surprise move, and it took them just 45 minutes.
Have you heard from Mooch?
No, Mr. Reardon. She stressed the no. It was the office boy from the 5th floor who came running in to tell me he'd just heard it on the radio. I called the newspapers to verify it. I tried to reach Mr. Mooch in Washington. His office does not answer.
When did we hear from him last?
10 days ago, Mr. Reardon.
All right. Thank you, Gwen. Keep trying to get his office.
Yes, Mr. Reardon.
She walked out. Mr. Ward was on his feet, hat in hand. He muttered, I guess I'd better. Sit down, Reardon snapped fiercely.
Mr. Ward obeyed, staring at him.
We had business to transact, didn't we? Said Reardon.
Mr. Ward could not define the emotion that contorted Reardon's mouth as he spoke.
Mr. Ward, what is it that the foulest bastards on earth denounce us for, among other things? Oh, yes, for our motto of business as usual. Well, business as usual, Mr. Ward.
He picked up the telephone receiver and asked for his superintendent.
Say, Pete.
What?
Yes, I've heard. Cannon. We'll talk about that later. What I want to know is, could you let me have 500 tons of steel extra above schedule in the next few weeks? Yes, I know. I know it's tough.
Give me the dates and the figures.
He listened, rapidly jotting notes down on a sheet of paper. Then he said,
Right, thank you, and hung up.
He studied the figures for a few moments, making some brief calculations on the margin of the sheet. Then he raised his head.
All right, Mr. Ward, he said. You will have your steel in 10 days.
When Mr. Ward had gone, Reardon came into the anteroom. He said to Miss Ives, his voice normal,
Wire Fleming in Colorado. He'll know why I have to cancel that option.
She inclined her head, in the manner of a nod signifying obedience. She did not look at him. He turned to his next caller and said, with a gesture of invitation toward his office,
How do you do? Come in.
He would think of it later, he thought. One moves step by step, and one must keep moving. For the moment, with an unnatural clarity, with a brutal simplification that made it almost easy, his consciousness contained nothing but one thought. It must not stop me. The sentence hung alone, with no past and no future. He did not think of what it was that must not stop him, or why this sentence was such a crucial absolute. It held him, and he obeyed. He went step by step. He completed his schedule of appointments as scheduled. It was late when his last caller departed, and he came out of his office. The rest of his staff had gone home. Miss Ives sat alone at her desk in an empty room. She sat straight and stiff, her hands clasped tightly together in her lap. Her head was not lowered, but held rigidly level, and her face seemed frozen. Tears were running down her cheeks, with no sound, with no facial movement, against her resistance, beyond control. She saw him and said dryly, guiltily, in apology, I'm sorry, Mr. Reardon, not attempting the futile pretense of hiding her face. He approached her. Thank you, he said gently. She looked up at him, astonished. He smiled.
But don't you think you're underestimating me, Gwen?
Isn't it too soon to cry over me? I could have taken the rest of it, she whispered. But they... She pointed at the newspapers on her desk. They're calling it a victory for anti-greed. He laughed aloud.
I can see where such a distortion of the English language would make you furious, he said. But what else?
As she looked at him, her mouth relaxed a little. The victim whom she could not protect was her only point of reassurance in a world dissolving around her. He moved his hand gently across her forehead. It was an unusual break of formality for him, and a silent acknowledgment of the things at which he had not laughed.
Go home, Gwen. I won't need you tonight. I'm going home myself in just a little while. No, I don't want you to wait.
It was past midnight when, still sitting at his desk, bent over blueprints of the bridge for the John Galt line, he stopped his work abruptly, because emotion reached him in a sudden stab.
not to be escaped any longer, as if a curtain of anesthesia had broken. He slumped down halfway, still holding on to some shred of resistance, and sat, his chest pressed to the edge of the desk to stop him, his head hanging down, as if the only achievement still possible to him was not to let his head drop down on the desk. He sat that way for a few moments, conscious of nothing but pain, a screaming pain without content or limit. He sat not knowing whether it was in his mind or his body, reduced to the terrible ugliness of pain that stopped thought. In a few moments it was over. He raised his head and sat up straight, quietly, leaning back against his chair. Now he saw that in postponing this moment for hours, he had not been guilty of evasion. He had not thought of it, because there was nothing to think. Thought, he told himself quietly, is a weapon one uses in order to act. No action was possible. Thought is the tool by which one makes a choice. No choice was left to him. Thought sets one's purpose and the way to reach it. In the matter of his life being torn piece by piece out of him, he was to have no voice, no purpose, no way, no defense. He thought of this in astonishment. He saw for the first time that he had never known fear, because against any disaster he had held the omnipotent cure of being able to act. No, he thought, not an assurance of victory. Who can ever have that? Only the chance to act, which is all one needs. Now he was contemplating impersonally, and for the first time, the real heart of terror. Being delivered to destruction, with one's hands tied behind one's back. Well then, go on with your hands tied, he thought. Go on in chains. Go on. It must not stop you. But another voice was telling him things he did not want to hear, while he fought back, crying through and against it. There's no point in thinking of that. There's no use. What for? Leave it alone. He could not choke it off. He sat still over the drawings of the bridge for the John Galt line and heard the things released by a voice that was part sound, part sight. They decided it without him. They did not call for him. They did not ask. They did not let him speak. They were not bound even by the duty to let him know, to let him know that they had slashed part of his life away and that he had to be ready to walk on as a cripple. Of all those concerned, whoever they were, for whichever reasons, for whatever need, he was the one they had not had to consider. The sign at the end of a long road said, Reardon Ore. It hung over black tiers of metal, and over years and nights, over a clock ticking drops of his blood away, the blood he had given gladly, exultantly in payment for a distant day, and a sign over a road. Paid for with his effort, his strength, his mind, his hope, destroyed at the whim of some men who sat and voted. Who knows by what minds? Who knows whose will had placed them in power? What motive moved them? What was their knowledge? Which one of them, unaided, could bring a chunk of ore out of the earth? Destroyed at the whim of men whom he had never seen, and who had never seen those tiers of metal. Destroyed because they so decided. By what right? He shook his head. There are things one must not contemplate, he thought. There is an obscenity of evil which contaminates the observer. There is a limit to what it is proper for a man to see. He must not think of this, or look within it, or try to learn the nature of its roots. Feeling quiet and empty, he told himself that he would be all right tomorrow. He would forgive himself the weakness of this night. It was like the tears one is permitted at a funeral, and then one learns how to live with an open wound, or with a crippled factory. He got up and walked to the window. The mill seemed deserted and still. He saw feeble snatches of red above black funnels, long coils of steam, webbed diagonals of cranes and bridges. He felt a desolate loneliness, of a kind he had never known before. He thought that Gwen Ives and Mr. Ward could look to him for hope, for relief, for renewal of courage. To whom could he look for it? He, too, needed it for once. He wished he had a friend who could be permitted to see him suffer without pretense or protection, on whom he could lean for a moment, just to say, "I'm very tired," and find a moment's rest. Of all the men he knew, was there one he wished he had beside him now? He heard the answer in his mind, immediate and shocking. Francisco d'Anconia. His chuckle of anger brought him back. The absurdity of the longing jolted him into calm. "That's what you get," he thought, "when you indulge yourself in weakness." He stood at the window trying not to think, but he kept hearing words in his mind. Reardon ore, Reardon coal, Reardon steel, Reardon metal. What was the use? Why had he done it? Why should he ever want to do anything again? His first day on the ledges of the ore mines, the day when he stood in the wind looking down at the ruins of a steel plant, the day when he stood here in this office at this window and thought that a bridge could be made to carry incredible loads on just a few bars of metal, if one combined a truss with an arch, if one built diagonal bracing with the top members curved too. He stopped and stood still. He had not thought of combining a truss with an arch that day. In the next moment he was at his desk, bending over it, with one knee on the seat of the chair, with no time to think of sitting down. He was drawing lines, curves, triangles, columns of calculations, indiscriminately on the blueprints, on the desk blotter, on somebody's letters. And an hour later he was calling for a long-distance line. He was waiting for a phone to ring by a bed in a railway car on a siding. He was saying, "Dagny, that bridge of ours, throw in the ash can all the drawings I sent you, because..." "What?" "Oh, that, to hell with that. Never mind the looters and their laws. Forget it. Dagny, what do we care? Listen, you know the contraption you call the Reardon truss that you admired so much? It's not worth a damn. I figured out a truss that will beat anything ever built. Your bridge will carry 4 trains at once, stand 300 years, and cost you less than your cheapest culvert. I'll send you the drawings in 2 days, but I wanted to tell you about it right now. You see, it's a matter of combining a truss with an arch. If we take diagonal bracing and..." "What?" "I can't hear you. Have you caught a cold?" "What are you thanking me for as yet? Wait till I explain it to you." Chapter 8. The John Galt Line. The worker smiled, looking at Eddie Willers across the table. "I feel like a fugitive," said Eddie Willers. "I guess you know why I haven't been here for months." He pointed at the underground cafeteria. "I'm supposed to be a vice president now, the vice president in charge of operation. For God's sake, don't take it seriously. I stood it as long as I could, and then I had to escape, if only for one evening. The first time I came down here for dinner after my alleged promotion, they all stared at me so much, I didn't dare come back." "Well, let them stare. You don't. I'm glad that it doesn't make any difference to you." "No, I haven't seen her for 2 weeks, but I speak to her on the phone every day, sometimes twice a day. Yes, I know how she feels. She loves it. What is it we hear over the telephone? Sound vibrations, isn't it? Well, her voice sounds as if it were turning into light vibrations, if you know what I mean. She enjoys running that horrible battle single-handed and winning." "Oh, yes, she's winning. Do you know why you haven't read anything about the John Galt Line in the newspapers for some time? Because it's going so well. Only, that Reardon metal rail will be the greatest track ever built. But what will be the use if we don't have any engines powerful enough to take advantage of it? Look at the kind of patched coal burners we've got left. They can barely manage to drag themselves fast enough for old trolley car rails. Still, there's hope. The United Locomotive Works went bankrupt. That's the best break we've had in the last few weeks, because their plant has been bought by Dwight Sanders. He's a brilliant young engineer who's got the only good aircraft plant in the country. He had to sell the aircraft plant to his brother in order to take over United Locomotive. That's on account of the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. Sure, it's just a setup between them, but can you blame him? Anyway, we'll see diesels coming out of the United Locomotive Works now. Dwight Sanders will start things going." "Yes, she's counting on him. Why do you ask that?" "Yes, he's crucially important to us right now. We've just signed a contract with him for the first 10 diesel engines he'll build. When I phoned her that the contract was signed, she laughed and said, 'You see, is there ever any reason to be afraid?' She said that because she knows. I've never told her, but she knows that I'm afraid.
Yes, I am.
I don't know. I wouldn't be afraid if I knew of what. I could do something about it, but this... Tell me, don't you really despise me for being operating vice president? But don't you see that it's vicious?
What honor? I don't know what it is that I really am, a clown, a ghost, an understudy, or just a rotten stooge. When I sit in her office, in her chair, at her desk, I feel worse than that. I feel like a murderer. Sure, I know that I'm supposed to be a stooge for her, and that would be an honor, but
I feel as if in some horrible way, which I can't quite grasp, I'm a stooge for Jim Taggart. Why should it be necessary for her to have a stooge? What does she have to hide? Why did they throw her out of the building? Do you know that she had to move out into a dinky hole in the back alley across from our express and baggage entrance? You ought to take a look at it sometime. That's the office of John Galt Incorporated. Yet everybody knows that it's she who's still running Taggart Transcontinental. Why does she have to hide the magnificent job she's doing? Why are they giving her no credit? Why are they robbing her of her achievement, with me as the receiver of stolen goods? Why are they doing everything in their power to make it impossible for her to succeed, when she is all they've got standing between them and destruction? Why are they torturing her in return for saving their lives? What's the matter with you? Why do you look at me like that? Yes, I guess you understand. There's something about it all that I can't define, and it's something evil. That's why I'm afraid. I don't think one can get away with it. You know, it's strange, but I think they know it too, Jim and his crowd, and all of them in the building. There's something guilty and sneaky about the whole place. Guilty and sneaky and dead. Taggart Transcontinental is now like a man who's lost his soul, who's betrayed his soul. No, she doesn't care. Last time she was in New York, she came in unexpectedly. I was in my office, in her office, and suddenly the door opened and there she was. She came in saying, "Mr. Willers, I'm looking for a job as a station operator. Would you give me a chance?" I wanted to damn them all, but I had to laugh. I was so glad to see her, and she was laughing so happily. She had come straight from the airport. She wore slacks and a flying jacket. She looked wonderful. She'd got windburned, and it looks like a suntan, just as if she'd returned from a vacation. She made me remain where I was, in her chair, and she sat on the desk and talked about the new bridge of the John Galt line. No, I never asked her why she chose that name. I don't know what it means to her. A sort of challenge, I guess. I don't know to whom. Oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean a thing. There isn't any John Galt. But I wish she hadn't used it. I don't like it, do you?
You do? You don't sound very happy saying it.
The windows of the offices of the John Galt line faced a dark alley. Looking up from her desk, Dagny could not see the sky, only the wall of a building rising past her range of vision. It was the side wall of the great skyscraper of Taggart Transcontinental. Her new headquarters were two rooms on the ground floor of a half-collapsed structure. The structure still stood, but its upper stories were boarded off as unsafe for occupancy. Such tenants as it sheltered were half-bankrupt, existing as it did, on the inertia of the momentum of the past. She liked her new place. It saved money. The rooms contained no superfluous furniture or people. The furniture had come from junk shops. The people were the choice best she could find. On her rare visits to New York, she had no time to notice the room where she worked. She noticed only that it served its purpose. She did not know what made her stop tonight and look at the thin streaks of rain on the glass of the window, at the wall of the building across the alley. It was past midnight. Her small staff had gone. She was due at the airport at 3 a.m. to fly her plane back to Colorado. She had little left to do, only a few of Eddie's reports to read. With the sudden break of the tension of hurrying, she stopped, unable to go on. The report seemed to require an effort beyond her power. It was too late to go home and sleep, too early to go to the airport. She thought, "You're tired," and watched her own mood with severe, contemptuous detachment, knowing that it would pass. She had flown to New York unexpectedly at a moment's notice, leaping to the controls of her plane within 20 minutes after hearing a brief item in a news broadcast. The radio voice had said that Dwight Sanders had retired from business, suddenly, without reason or explanation. She had hurried to New York, hoping to find him and stop him. But she had felt, while flying across the continent, that there would be no trace of him to find.